and Neurodiversity Alliance. We are DNA. We provide support for students who are having difficulty with their schooling or accessing the services they need. Email access@sfss.ca or drop by the DNA Resource Center, room 1300 in the sub-building. That was access@sfss.ca, room 1300 in the sub-building.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Sunny La.
Kwe.
Why eat beach nak seal?
Tan She.
Tanet E. Negad Dakote.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Kwe, Nin Deluizi, Pam Palmiter. Hi, my name's Pam Palmiter, and I'm your host for the Mi'kmaq episodes of Words and Culture. I'm a member of Ugbaganjig, otherwise known as Eel River Bar First Nation, and that's one of the 29 Mi'kmaq First Nations that make up our larger Mi'kmaq nation. Our territory is known as Mi'kma'ki and comprises all of PEI Nova Scotia and parts of New Brunswick, Newfoundland, Quebec, and even Maine. And while we're going to visit with mainly Mi'kmaq speakers, in an upcoming episode, I'm also going to squeeze in one of my Wolastoqua cousins, Jeremy Dutcher. I'm so excited to be part of Words and Culture because Indigenous language revitalization and protection is so important to me. Colonial governments tried to wipe out our people, our cultures, and our languages, and we need to do anything and everything to protect them from extinction. I've been on my own journey to learn the Mi'kmaq language because I'm not fluent. That's why I'm so excited to see what I can learn from our upcoming guests. My first guest is Jarvis Gugu. He's super smart and he speaks all over the Maritimes about Mi'kmaq history and culture. He is literally the embodiment of what it means to share our culture with the world. He's a marathon runner with a law degree and the host of the TV show Mi'kma'ki, which I love watching when I'm back home. Let's meet him. Kwe, hello, Jarvis. Up Jalazi, welcome to Words and Culture.
Nin Deluizi, Jarvis Gugu, Wittebeski, Wegama, Unamagi, Nige, Delewi, Jibukduk, Sibinagadikdo. So, hi, my name is Jarvis Gugu. I am originally from Wegama First Nation. It's where my connections or family origins are. Currently, I live in Halifax, otherwise known as the Great Harbor, in the Mi'kmaq district of Sibinagadik.
I try to follow everything you do, and it's nearly impossible for me to keep up with you. You are always speaking somewhere. Aside from running in all these massive marathons, you're speaking at universities, schools, churches, media outlets, all about Mi'kmaq culture and history. Where did your passion come from to want to share our culture with the world?
It started basically somewhat towards the end, but really it picked up, I would say, in the early start of the pandemic. A friend of mine, she asked if I would speak to her kids. And of course, the pandemic being what it was, we said, okay, we have to do an outdoor space for safety, but something culturally significant. So of course, we're in HRM. We thought Bedford Petroglyphs. We'll do it up there instead. So, of course, these were bark carvings in stone done by Mi'kmaq ancestors from hundreds of years ago. And while there, being masked, being distant, I wanted to demonstrate a sweetgrass budget. So I wanted to demonstrate that for the kids. And I was just giving them little tidbits of information here and there. And what I love doing is explaining Mi'kmaq being verb-oriented. So a bit of back history with me and the language. So raised on reserve by my grandmother, Mi'kmaq was her first language, but she did not speak Mi'kmaq to me growing up because you may have known or heard of the incorrect but honestly held mistaken belief was that I needed to speak English to succeed in the colonial world we are living in today, and Mi'kmaq should not be my first language. We know today, of course, that is false. You have people who speak multiple languages who are so successful in a multitude of areas. You know, if anything, speaking multiple languages is good for the brain and all that jazz. So, nevertheless, she spoke to me in English growing up. I had some very little Mi'kmaq education in school because I went to an Indian day school in elementary. So grade primary, grade one, two of my Mi'kmaq language teachers were Indian residential school survivor Phyllis Gugu and another Indian day school survivor, Caroline Phillips. Both have passed away since. But I remember learning basic animals, basic counting, at least in primary and grade one. And then from grade two till, essentially junior high, I got very little formal Mi'kmaq language education. So my friends spoke Mi'kmaq. Like my best friends, like, you know, Roe, Clint back home, they spoke Mi'kmaq. So I would hear it here and there, but directly to me, they would mention a word, but not really say anything much. I've heard people in the family talk to each other Mi'kmaq, but they would address me in English. And then I would say, you know, junior high, high school, when we basically, I'll be blunt with my language, we basically kicked out the feds in our education and we took control of Mi'kmaq education on the reserve. And then we started bringing in Mi'kmaq Ginatmwe for Mi'kmaq education jurisdiction in Nova Scotia, at least. And then I started getting more Mi'kmaq language as a part of the school curriculum. And that's when I started learning more about Smith Francis, the various different types of writing systems, orthographies that we have. I started learning more words, but to me it was like, duh, I got by with a 70 or an 80 in class. I wasn't an A-plus student, at least with the language. And then when I went into university, I lived with 18 people, 16 white, one black, and me. And we had, I believe, at least one person who was from Quebec who spoke French as a second language. And hanging out with them, talking with them, interacting, that's when I started realizing, oh my God, I'm the only person here who speaks Mi'kmaq. Barely, but I could speak some. And that's how kind of why I had that epiphany in first year. I'm like, holy geez, I kind of feel like a special code talker of some sort. I speak a language no one here knows, albeit very weakly. And that's kind of where I like really started taking more of an active approach to learn it, speak it, throw out little words here and there. It took basically leaving the reserve and then being around other people saying, my God, I kind of feel like I'm not sure how to say it, but I don't know if I feel endangered or I should feel protected. I'm the only one who has knowledge here, probably in the whole university. I met there were other Mi'kmaq people that I went to university with. To the best of my knowledge, none of them spoke Mi'kmaq. But for a variety of reasons, sometimes language weakens or dies off generation after generation. It just happens. So I would for about 10 years, I would always try and make an effort here and there to learn little bits here and there. But to me, the big epiphany, the big learning opportunity happened in October 2010 at Tanligush in northern Nova Scotia. There is a learning center. They have been doing some good work with Mi'kmaq communities, elders, etc. And that's what I loved about that camp, was just not learning the word, not just so much the translation, meaning behind it. Why is it this way? Why is it called this way? And of course, the big examples I love talking about are sun and moon. So of course, in Mi'kmaq, we call the word sun. It legit doesn't translate to sun. I think sun comes from sol or soul. I think it's a Greek word. Our word for it is, as I mentioned, naguset, which legit translates to it shines at day. The sun shines at day. And I love learning the breakdown of the words behind it. I want to know, why do we call it that? Because it's shine at day. Likewise with the moon. Today, of course, with science, we know the moon is actually reflecting the light off of the sun. But in English, in Mi'kmaq, it translates to it shines at night, because the moon shines very brightly at night. And the other thing I wanted to share was, it's a personal story, but last year, my godfather, my Ngekwinet, he passed away from cancer. My biological father's white. I don't know him. Never met him. He's been never in a picture in my family. And I think it's part of the reason why I was raised by my grandmother because my biological mother, who I'm close with, was very young when she had me. And so my godfather, I might cry, I'll try not to, was basically the father figure to me. Like, you know, think of Uncle Phil from like The Fresh Prince. That's what he was to me. And in Mi'kmaq, I used to hear the term Inklamuksis. I used to call that to my godfather, my uncle. I initially thought it meant my uncle, which it does mean my uncle. We're talking about family relationships within the language. So Inklamuksis does mean, it refers to your uncle, but it legit translates to he who takes care of me. And when I learned that, I said, I don't know why, but that's why I always called him Inklamuksis. Even though he was my Ingekwit, my godfather, I called him Inklamuksis because I said, he took care of me.
Wow.
Yeah. So to me, it's not just learning the word. It's the relationship, the meaning behind the word. And what's awesome and amazing, there's so much of that in Mi'kmaq. So when I teach it to myself, I like to learn the word, but I like to explain some history of the word, the language of the word.
I love that. So I think this is the stuff that people need to understand about language. So when I used to work for the feds and I had to go become bilingual in French, and everything was like a direct translation. So the word for cat, sha, like it was a direct word for word translation. But what I've discovered from Mi'kmaq language speakers or people like you who are further on their journey than I am is that it's not a word for word translation. So like when all these communities started taking back their names, so for us, instead of Eel River Bar, it's Ugbaganjig, but Ugbaganjig doesn't mean Eel River Bar. It's like where the waters meet. And which waters? Well, it's the Eel River and the Bay of Chaleur, and there's like this movement, and it's like, what? Wow. I love that. So it's like so beyond words, and it has meaning. And I've been dying to ask you about, you know how there's this trend now for our Mi'kmaq communities to go from the name that they might have been given to a Mi'kmaq name. How important is that for like culture, but also language revitalization?
I believe recently what was formerly called the Acadia First Nation has started working towards reclaiming the original name of their community. I do believe, I do take practice with it, is Wahosaba. Or Wahosobe. And I believe it legit translates to bright water. I do probably need to do a little more research into why, how. Of course, I'm guessing it's probably something around the Bay of Fundy being bright. It could be something with that. To me, the way I also see it is, so Vancouver, British Columbia, it's beautiful. And I said, if I was living in Mi'kma'ki, I would live there. And the first time I was in Vancouver, 2016, a friend of mine, a white woman I met at St. Mary's, who's a really good friend of mine, she drove me around. She had a vehicle, and we got to see various places here and there. And I was just fascinated and amazed that depending where you were outside the city, you saw the original indigenous name of the place, and then you saw what it was called in English. And the number one thing I said was, you can do that around here. We know the names of places. And it's not just the communities. It's like, right, I mentioned Lake Morris just down the hill. Yes, you can pop a sign called Lake Morris. Also, I want another sign beside it says Lochotuch. That is what we call it in Mi'kmaq. And before we all flip and freak out, I'm going to say, well, if you go to Quebec, I would presume most signs are bilingual. You go to Europe, a lot of countries there are in multiple signs in multiple languages. That's great. That's wonderful. Let's do it here with Mi'kmaq. You go to Cape Breton, they now have a sign that says Bijilasi Unamagi. You know, welcome to Cape Breton. And that was spearheaded by another Indian residential school survivor, Margaret Pullet of Waygomah, where I'm from. So I'm like, I know some people got mad. I'm like, what's wrong with a second sign? It's in Mi'kmaq. You have once you get on the island, their signs are written in English and Gaelic. That's good for the Gaelic language. What about the Mi'kmaq language, the older original language that's been here for thousands of years, long before any European language got here in the first place? So sometimes I get a little frustrated and mad, and I'm going to say this, when people are complaining to immigrants about learn English, speak French, you are in Canada. I'm like, yeah, you're in Mi'kmaq. If you, before you complain about immigrants or anyone else who are having challenges and difficulties with English, I want to see you try and speak Mi'kmaq.
I totally agree. I think about different reserves I've been on, and their stop signs are in both languages. They're like all of their signs. And I thought, what actually stops provinces and cities from just extending that? It doesn't hurt anyone. The English will still be there. You'll still know where you are, but you'll also know where you really are. Because of the Mi'kmaq language.
Yeah. And it's funny you said that about English. So you may recall back in April 2020, so the early glory days of the pandemic, there I decided to watch virtually a Halifax town hall meeting, which discussed the findings of the report on the commemoration of Edward Cornwallis and Indigenous history in HRM. Lean, I cannot remember if it was that session itself or leading up to it. I heard something very powerful from former HRM counselor Wei Mason. And he was advocating for more on Mi'kmaq representation. Of course, you get the whole typical pushback, rewriting history or erasing history, which is absolutely not happening here. We want to expose, share all of history. And of course, one of these people were just getting mad, were erasing the original history. And Wei said something to the effect that stuck with me. He said, the colonial history is not going to be erased. Case in point, we are conducting this entire conversation in English. Why are you worried about Mi'kmaq history being promoted and shared here in this region? If, you know, language is core and the very basics and fundamental, the whole fact this discussion was even being done in English says a lot that you don't have to worry about English history being erased here because it is the dominant language. And, you know, it's one of those things I've often heard going back to high school from, you know, the studies I've done in, you know, on language and native history was people who think, who speak differently tend to think differently. And I always say, you know what? Yeah, that's the case. It's not better or worse. You just have a different way, different view of seeing things.
So much. I mean, everything that you're saying just makes so much sense about my, you know, limited understanding about all of the orthography that you wouldn't say I and then whatever square something or other that it's like what it does. I love that whole concept of verbs and that we see things, more living things than just humans. And I had a question because, you know, how some of our people grew up in a fluent household and so they became fluent or, you know, something like that. And then there's people who never were in a fluent household. Like, for example, my dad lived on the res with my granny and they were fluent when he was younger, but then she told him, oh, you're not going to get anywhere with Mi'kmaq. So he didn't learn it to even be able to pass it on to me. So, you know, took a language course in university, tried to use the Mi'kmaq dictionary, tried to read all the awesome, like, kids books, Mi'kmaq kids books that are there now with letters and numbers from our Mi'kmaq people. But what are some other ways? Like, are there any other ways that people like me or people just starting out can take these baby steps to learn Mi'kmaq when you're not in a fluent household?
Why? One of my favorite things I love doing is there's an app that's produced by Mi'kmaq Gnawa. Viewers won't see this, but I'm going to read off the app to you. It's the Mi'kmaq language app, and it is called Inluisi. So the spelling of that is capital L, an apostrophe, N-U-I, an apostrophe, S-U-T-I. And it's a Mi'kmaq language app that's operated by Mi'kmaq Gnawa, so all fluent speakers. There's information about who's saying the words, a bit about the language, oral history, and the written part. And what's neat about it is it's broken down by categories. So you have animals, body parts, time of the year. One of my favorites that for my wife, it's commands. And she will learn, she learns those quick. Emotions, family, food, etc., holidays. There's a lot there. And for me, I try to practice with it. And like the Mi'kmaq Online Talking Dictionary, which I believe is produced out of Lestigouche First Nation, once in a while I jump on it. I try to learn a basic word here and there and then use it in an everyday context in whatever way. The other thing I like to do is, so I do subscribe to YouTube Premium, and that allows you to download videos. There are some English to Mi'kmaq translation videos done by speakers. And while driving or going for a walk, I just play it in the background just to hear it over and over again. I'll replay the same video over and over again. To me, I consider that my immersion. I'm like, just dump me in it. Just speak it to me. It will force me to learn. And I like what you said earlier, too, about children's books. Duma Young shared something with me amazing. So he grew up, when he was younger, in the community of Malakawatch First Nation, which, as we know, Central Isolation devastated. And then he became a band member of Eskasoni First Nation. He told me a story that when he was younger, there was a white family from California that had a cottage near where Malakawatch was. And so, of course, Duma's family and the parents of that family there just naturally became friends because they spent the summers just outside Malakawatch meeting with the family. And there were children who were Duma's age. And, of course, they're playing with each other. Duma and his friends or siblings, I can't remember, they're all speaking Mi'kmaq as a first language, English is the second. And they're playing with these white kids from California. And Duma would say by the end of the summer, those kids were speaking a bit more Mi'kmaq. Children are resilient. Just keep speaking it to them. They catch on with it.
I love this. And I love your passion too. You're just getting me all riled up because I think sometimes, and you know, everyone has a different perspective on things, but there are some people in the world who say, oh, if you're not already fluent, oh, you're not Mi'kmaq. You know, like kind of like gatekeepers and not wanting to share. Or people who say, oh, you can, you know, go on your journey to learn the language, but it can only be done in ceremony, or it can only be done in this one place by certain people. And I've always worried that if you put too many rules and limitations on learning the language, then we're going to miss out on all the youth who would learn from an app, who would learn from YouTube, who would learn from music, who would learn from all these cool books and things. And it's just, oh, it's just music to my ears to hear you mention literally all of these things.
Yeah. Thank you. Happy to say, so this kind of leads into something else. And I do have a part-time job as a host of a television show called Mi'kma'ki. We did film season one, variety, random topics. We're in season two, pre-production, and we are hoping to speak with some fluent Mi'kmaq instructors, teachers, and not just people who teach in the university. We are scheduled to speak with a Mi'kmaq language tech studio in Eskasoni. They were a part of the Blackbird being sung in Mi'kmaq a couple of years ago that caught the attention of Paul McCartney, Mayor of Wings. And they are also developing a video game with Mi'kmaq story, folklore, legend, and art being done with it. And the overall voice of it is being done by Bernie Francis. And the way I see it is, it's all fronts. How we are learning, how are you and I speaking and learning English? Books, TVs, movies, etc. And the way I see it is, everything, including the kitchen sink. Throw anything and everything with Mi'kmaq language out there. Video games? Sure. A podcast? Great. An app? Great. A book? A conversation with an elder. A conversation with my best friends. Me talking to my dogs in Mi'kmaq. And I will talk to my dogs in Mi'kmaq sometimes. Any and every little bit where I can throw it, it contributes to learn it in some way.
That's wonderful. And shout out to Bernie Francis, because there isn't a Mi'kmaq person that I have met who hasn't said, oh yeah, if I have a question about the Mi'kmaq language, I text or call or email Bernie, and he has helped me with so many things. I love him. That was Jarvis Gugu. He's a marathon-running lawyer and host of TV show Mi'kma'ki. Jarvis Gugu just made me excited all over again to keep on my journey to learn the Mi'kmaq language and share our culture with the world. I'm Pam Palmiter. For more episodes of Words and Culture, check out our website at wordsandculture.ca. Now I'm going to leave you with more of Emma Stevens, who had a hit singing the Beatles song Blackbird in Mi'kmaq. Thanks for listening, everyone. The Moltis. Now that's going to be on my brain all day.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Hausin Dan King Sam.
Maltis.
Ninuis Ahaha Miku Kwakwal.
Kachu Nautano.
The Wapamatin Mina.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you from Simon Fraser University's Burnaby campus in British Columbia.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, but
what happens in the Arctic does not stay in the Arctic.
That's Walt Meyer, a senior research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado. He says Arctic sea ice is shrinking dramatically. Each March, sea ice covers a greater area than at any other time of the year. But this year, that peak coverage was the lowest on record since satellites began measuring it in 1979. This decline has far-reaching consequences, because sea ice acts as an air conditioner for the Earth's climate. The white sea ice reflects a lot of sunlight back into space, while dark open ocean absorbs more solar energy as heat. So as the ice shrinks and more water is exposed, temperatures are rising quickly.
The Arctic is warming about 3 times as fast as the rest of the globe, largely due to the loss of sea ice.
And Meyer says Arctic warming can affect weather patterns at lower latitudes.
We can potentially get more extreme weather, more extreme heat waves, and potentially more extreme storms.
So Meyer says that the rapid loss of sea ice in the Arctic has consequences around the world and indicates bigger changes to come. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.